Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and broadcast through the Community Radio Network. It's always a pleasure to bring you through their stories, life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. Welcome to part two of the life and times of Charles Palagi. I'm Rob Greaves and it's great to have your company as we move through part two of Charles's story. In part one, we learned both the positive and negative experiences Charles went through as a young boy in German-occupied Hungary during World War II. A boy who had a Hungarian father, but a German mother. In this program, Charles talks extensively about being resettled by the Russians at the end of World War II and how, by sheer luck, they avoided being shot by the Russians and being taken in by the Americans. The family's experiences with the occupying Americans as refugees was very positive. Wanting to immigrate, Charles's father realised that the waiting list for the United States and Canada was very long. A highly educated man, Charles's father was offered a full professorship in South America, but he understood that the region was politically unstable and chose Australia. Charles's stories of his trip on the boat to Australia are only bettered by his stories of the family's arrival and life in Australia, a life that started off in the migrant camp in Bonegella, Victoria. His father's degree was not recognised for some 15 years, so for a long time, the family did it tough. The story of how a young Charles fell on his feet earning £8 a week while his father only earned £5 a week is amazing. And it led to him being offered a position that could have led him, in turn, to being a very wealthy man. But his father said, no, it's a university life for my Charles. We pick up with Charles taking us back to Hungary and the conclusion of his story of him injuring a young boy who was in a different gang.
I'm just sorry for the Polish boy because the Russians wouldn't have had antibiotics, I don't think, in those days. So I don't know what happened to him.
But what it reinforces is the kids do things without understanding the consequences until it's in their face. Like, you know, throwing a flower pot because it's a gang thing. But when you saw that kid injured...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you realise it's...
I wouldn't have wanted that. I certainly wanted to hurt him.
But, yes, but, yeah, I understand. Yeah. So when you went out of the relocation camp, was that to find a life in Germany or was that to immigrate?
Well, there was no intention there. The Russians wanted to repatriate everybody back to Hungary and Poland.
Right.
Because they made a big song and dance about it, that they were humanitarian and relocating people. And we were put on a train as Hungarians to be taken back to Hungary.
Oh, okay.
Now, we were very fortunate because later in Australia, Hungarian survivors told us what happened to those trains. And I can imagine why the Russians would have done this, because Russians were already under pressure to feed the satellite countries, like Hungary would have been starving. They didn't want refugees coming back. The story we were told in Australia is that those trains would stop in a forest, everybody would be offloaded, shot, buried in trenches, and then the train would go back for more. Now, in our case, we were very fortunate with our train because the train, as it was going back to Hungary, came across a lot of bombed-out tracks, so it had to meander and detour through the American zone. And the Americans must have known what was happening, and they ordered everybody off the train at the protest of the Russian guards. And that's how we ended up on the American zone.
Okay, wow. Again, tying this back to the manse being left unbombed, these circumstances seem to be, if I can call them circumstances, happening to your family, which removed them from danger.
Yeah, and Rob, many more, which I described on that website.
Right. So you found yourself in American-occupied territory.
Yes, and that was good. My dad got a good job polishing the cars of the American officers who brought their limousines from the States. I nearly got run over by one because in Germany, you know, all the cars like the VW were very noisy cars. And so whenever I would cross the street in Germany, I never looked left or right.
Because you could hear them coming.
Yeah. Oh, so I never bothered to look. And this American limousine just glided past and nearly hit me. Oh, I got the fright of my life. From then on, I looked left and right.
Yes. I bet you did.
The Americans were very friendly. And that was shown when we came down from the hills just towards the end of the war, where we escaped being bombed in trenches, because we came into this town that was reduced to rubble. And we came across an old lady, because the whole place was deserted. And she said, sorry, I'm backtracking a bit, but I want to highlight how friendly Americans were. She told us, oh, you'd better report at the town hall. Everybody has to register. And the Americans said that if you don't register, anybody on the found on the streets would be shot. And we took that seriously. And so we started going towards the town hall, which the old lady pointed out. And just then at the end of the street, an American Jeep with four soldiers came towards us. And so my parents were shocked, you know, because we were out in the open. And so my mum decided to use her best imitation of French, willing to forego her German nationality. And as soon as the Jeep approached us, she shouted out at them. She meant to say, we're from Hungary, mm-hmm. but we're not Germans. She said, we are hungry, hungry. So the Jeep stopped, the soldiers laughed, got off and fed us with chocolates and chewing gum and other items.
What a treat that was.
They were so friendly.
Right.
And that was my recollection of American soldiers throughout the occupation until 1949. The soldiers on the street were very friendly, especially towards kids. Yeah.
So how did you get from that situation to being here in Australia?
All right. We were in refugee camps. But by that stage in the American zone, we were actually given a private residence in an apartment house. And it was advertised that it was possible to immigrate to America, Canada, South America, Australia. And America and Canada was, the waiting queues were so long. My dad said, we can't afford to wait that long. We're not having a good time here in Germany, because he was struggling to meet ends. And so he said, let's go to Australia, even though he was offered a full professorship in South America, even to lecture in German.
And a lot of Germans went to South America.
A lot of Germans escaped to, even before the war, to South America. And a lot of the war criminals ended up there as well.
That's right, exactly.
But my dad said, no, no, I know about South America. It's politically so unstable. Oh, we don't want to go there. So he chose Australia.
Oh, okay. Did you know anything about Australia?
No, the only thing that we knew about Australia was that money grew on trees and that the birds in the forests talk like babies. Now, I always thought, well, that was what a stupid comment to make thinking back all those years. But actually, one day, it was only about 3 years ago in the bush, I was walking along and I actually thought I heard a baby cry. But it must have been a lyrebird.
Lyrebird, of course.
You know.
That's funny how that imagery again came back after all that time when you heard it. Remember that's
That's right. Voices, smells, sights, they all trigger memories from the past, memories that I'd almost forgotten.
Yes.
You know, when I visited Germany back in the 70s, I smelt bitumen. Now, German bitumen in the war years smelt very different to Australian bitumen. So immediately it took me back as a street kid in Germany with the road workers working with hot tar.
Fascinating. You know. Absolutely amazing stuff. Yeah.
Even in America in 1971, I was doing postdoctoral research in America with my family. Sorry, I'm jumping forward, but I'll go back again. But just talking about smells, I was an American. I really missed a smell and about Australia, and I couldn't tell what the smell was. But I missed it, and I was thinking, what is it that I'm missing in America? And when we got back to Australia, I realized it was the dusty roads, the smell of dust. Especially of wet dust. Do you know that fragrance?
It does, yes.
Which a fungus apparently lets off when it gets wetted. And I missed that smell in America. Goodness, because every road was sealed in America where we were in Michigan.
Of course.
Yeah.
So Was it a boat trip to Australia?
Ah, yes. We went through various refugee camps in Italy. Mm-hmm. We were taken by cattle wagons, but we were fed well.
Okay.
And in every refugee camp in Italy, we were sort of waiting stations, really, for the next ship. We lived in tents, in American Army tents. And they were good. The only bad thing I remember about it is that the toilets were just big holes drilled into the ground. Mm. And there were Hessian bags just sort of tied around poles for privacy. But every now and again, a breeze would come, lift the Hessian bags, and all these ice cream vendors who came near the barbed wire to sell us ice cream, they could see me sitting there. It was so embarrassing. I hated going to the toilet. Of course you did.
I can only imagine what the women thought having to do
with it. Oh, yeah. Well, they would have had it worse.
That's right. But that's the way
That's the way it was. It was all prepared in a rush. Because the refugee numbers were enormous.
Huge, yes.
And so finally in Naples, we boarded the Fair Sea, which was an American troop carrier in those days. Of course,
it became a passenger cruise ship. Yes.
But on the Fair Sea, the men were put into a large cabin holding 500 people. I suppose that was the cargo hold, full of hammocks. You know, it was used as a troop carrier during the war.
No, that couldn't have been pleasant, surely.
Well, as a boy, I didn't care.
Again.
But it wouldn't have been pleasant for my dad.
Yes.
My mum and sister had a cabin to themselves with two other ladies, but they got horribly seasick in their cabin, so the women had better accommodation. I wasn't ever seasick on this ship, even though it rolled badly. They'd taken out the water ballasts to make the passage faster, and so the ship rolled like anything. And for 2 days on the Indian Ocean, the ship actually lost power.
Oh.
And so we were just bobbing around a cork. And so they got very seasick. But at that time, I'd won the under-15 chess championship on board.
Oh, good for you.
I was about 10. And my prize was an American dollar.
How wonderful.
And I was looking forward to going to the little kiosk on board to buy some lollies or whatever. But my dad said, no, son, you've got to buy a lemon, a bag of lemons for your mum and sister because they're very seasick and that will help them. So there went my American dollar for a bag of lemons.
Well, look, I mean, you look back now and it was disappointing as a boy, but it was a good cause, wasn't it? I mean,
oh, it was, yes. I didn't mind in the least. I mean, on the one hand, I would have regretted it, but I was glad to be of help.
Yes.
That I'd done something useful for the family.
Was it a boring trip? Because there wouldn't have been much to do.
There were good breakfasts.
Oh, okay.
To which very few people turned up.
Of course, because they're seasick. Yes.
But the crew was Italian. They had these lovely bread rolls, crusty bread rolls. And I was dying every morning to get another bread roll. And I ate everybody else's who hadn't turned up. The only sickening thing about the whole voyage for me was that the ship only seemed to have one record that they played constantly. It was the Donkey Serenade. Do you remember?
Can you listen to that today?
Well, I couldn't listen to it for about 30 years.
I understand.
Oh, just made me sick. But now I can listen to it again.
There's a song in the air, but the fair senorita doesn't seem to care for the song in the air. So I'll sing to the mule, if you're sure she won't think that I am just a fool, serenading a mule. Amigo mio, does she not have a dainty bray? She listens carefully to each little tune you play.
And this is Listen to Older Voices, a program that presents the stories of everyday Australians through the recollection of their lives.
I'm Rob Greaves and I'm talking with Charles Palagy, and Charles is recollecting the journey by ship from post-war Europe to Australia.
But the rolling ship and the congestion on board and this record playing over and over.
The imagery is wonderful.
Yeah.
So where did you land in Australia?
Well, we ended up in Port Phillip Bay, Melbourne, got off at Station Pier and taken by train in the middle of the night to Bonegilla.
Oh, so you wouldn't see much.
Albury. Then. Except that it was a moonlit night, and I was so keen I couldn't sleep on the train. I looked at the passing scenery and it was very mysterious, you know, gum trees, which I'd never seen before, all those dead fallen logs in the pastures. And that was something new for me. And in the morning, when we woke up in Bonegilla every morning, the first thing we heard was the warbling of the magpies, and that was a beautiful sound, something I'd never heard before.
No,
and that was
not.
Wonderful to wake up every morning to magpie sound. And on my website, I even put a link to magpies just so that my readers could experience, for those who are international,
yes,
a warbling of a magpie.
What was the camp like, Bonegilla?
Well, for me, it was adventurous. For the adults, it wouldn't have been so pleasant because we were in those round iron galvanized huts.
Yes.
And there were only blankets separating one family from another.
Oh, not much privacy then.
No.
No.
So everything could be heard and often seen, you know. And it was the same back in Germany too, in that Russian camp. I remember one picture which might interest you. We as kids used to, in the Russian camp in Germany, we used to laugh at this lady who had eight kids, and she had a big aluminium pot in which she would cook breakfast, lunch and dinner. And we all knew, because we heard about it, that at night it was the bedpan for the whole family.
Oh, no.
So we would gather around and just laugh at this family, you know.
Oh, dear.
Well, that wasn't that bad in Bonegilla. For a young boy like me, the adventurous thing was that there were rabbits everywhere, you know.
Oh,
myxomatosis hadn't been brought in yet.
No.
So the rabbits were all edible, and the cook would send us out with her own homemade slingshots, and we'd come back with about 24 rabbits, and the cook would cook them for everybody for lunch.
Well, that was not just a good job you did for everybody else, but that would have been great as a kid, be out there with a slingshot.
Oh, yeah, it was exciting to be shooting rabbits with a slingshot.
But you wouldn't have stayed in Bonegilla very long. Surely with your father's qualifications, he would have been highly desirable in terms of his work, wouldn't he?
I'm laughing, Rob, because for many years the Australian government didn't recognise European degrees. They were suspicious of them.
Oh, really?
And so my dad's degree wasn't recognised for about 15 years.
Even though he'd worked in some of the biggest industries in Germany.
Ah, yes, and people with high qualifications came as migrants, and none of them were recognised. Doctors and lawyers had to go back to university first year. Yeah, well, one funny story, which one of our close friends told us, that he applied for a job as a mechanical engineer in the engineering department at Melbourne University, and not wishing to discriminate against foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll have to give you a very hard test for you to just check out your qualifications. And they said, but we'll help you in your exam because we'll give you this textbook, and if you're quick enough, you'll find things in the index and look them up and help you to find your answers. And when he was given the textbook, he just couldn't help laughing because he said, but that's the textbook I wrote. This is an English translation of my textbook.
Oh, the embarrassment on their faces. I hope it was obvious.
It was very funny because it was so true, you know.
So where did the family go? I mean, Bonegilla couldn't have been your life for very long, surely. Where did you end up?
Well, my dad was put to work as a wood chopper for the army in Pacapaño.
Oh, that's a good thing for a chemical engineer.
Oh, yes, he regretted that because his hands were not used to hard work.
No.
After 6 months, my mum went and searched out accommodation in Melbourne, and we were put into St. Bede's College in Mentone. where my mum and dad ended up as a kitchen hand. That was my first schooling first at St. Bede's College.
Right.
I think we only stayed there for about a year, and that's where my name was changed, because my original name in Hungarian was Kalman. And I must have learned to speak English by then. I was watching the kids playing football, and this priest sat down beside me and he said, asked me, well, what's your name? Wanting to stir up a conversation. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, it's Kalman. And I pronounced it Kalman. And he said, oh, you're not the famous John Coleman, the Essendon full forward, right, are you? And I said, no. And he said, well, we mustn't let the boys think that you're John Coleman. So I'll tell you what, we'll call you Charles. It's a wonderful name. We'll call you Charles from now on. And we'll call your father Charles too. And so everybody in the kitchen got to know him as Charles, and me too.
Oh, dear.
Told all the teachers. And when I told this story at church one day about 4 years ago, the pastor there said, are you sure, Charles, you're legally married? Under what name did you get married?
Goodness.
And I said, well, I'm as Charles Palagy. Well, he said, you'd better check your wedding certificate and marriage certificate. So I did, but fortunately I put down Charles Kalman Palagy. So I said, okay, you're legal.
You
didn't have to get married a second time.
Okay. That could have been caused consternation.
Yes. And then from St. Bede's College, which only lasted, I don't know, a year to pay off our passage.
Mm.
My mum sought accommodation in the downtrodden areas in Melbourne on those days, so she went and found accommodation in Brunswick Street, Fitzroy.
Yes.
Where most of the migrants ended up.
Yes.
And she wrote a letter back to my dad, well, come to Fitzroy, I've got accommodation. Now, I don't know, Rob, whether you know Brunswick Street.
Oh, yes, I do.
It's a very long street.
Yes.
And she only wrote one letter.
Oh, didn't give an address.
No address. And she said, I can't remember the address, but you'll find a big cat sitting in front.
Oh.
Now, imagine. So the three of us arrived in Melbourne.
No.
Starting at the East Melbourne end of Brunswick Street, thank heavens, looking for a big cat. Sure enough, third house from the Penfolds Winery there, there was a huge cat sleeping in front of the house. And that was the house. Imagine if we had started at the other end in North Fitzroy.
You would have been camping out for the night. Fortuitous indeed.
Mm.
So how does a boy who, in your words, didn't really relate all that well to school and skip school whenever he could, end up in university?
Oh, well, that's a good story and a sad story for me personally, because I ended up being a street kid, because my mum was often sick. My dad was working hard to make ends meet, especially the pharmaceutical bills. So I ended up selling papers and moving around with the wrong people. But eventually, selling newspapers, I got this corner in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Corner of Collins Street and Elizabeth Street, which was a great place to sell papers, because after working hours, all the people would stream out of their offices in the business district and go to Flinders Street, and they didn't have TV in those days, so newspapers were very important.
Yes.
And I didn't have to sell very hard, because I was selling 500 a day.
Goodness me.
And so I was earning £8 a week. My dad was only getting £5 a week.
Oh.
So I had a lot of money to dispose.
Your parents would have been asking for money off you, though, wouldn't they?
Well, that's what I said about my dad. He never told me the value of money, even though my mum was sick, my sister had to go to work, who was 4 years older. He never sat me down and said, now, listen, son, you're earning all this money. How about giving a fraction of it towards the family? He never. So I spent it on Batman and Superman costumes, on bows and arrows from Myers. They were steel-stipped arrows and kids could buy them. Deadly things.
Because £8 was a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
So you never went for the things you wanted.
Well, I looked at the papers not so long ago, going back to the 1950s, and I discovered every 10 weeks, I could have bought a block of land in Fawkner.
Oh, goodness.
Every year, I could have bought a house in Currum on the beachside.
So your father didn't do you any favours at all then,
not that way.
Your money?
The only favour he did for me, I shouldn't say the only favour, but the big favour that was life-changing for me was that I was so good at selling papers and my money always was accounted for properly at night because I worked very long hours, skipping school, going to the news stand, selling my home editions right to the late editions of the Herald, becoming home at 9 in the evening. And so I skipped school, but the owner of the franchise for all the city blocks, at least of my part of the business district, offered me a full partnership, totally free. He said, look, you're 14 years old. How about if your dad takes you out of school, I'll make you full partner. You can run all the newsboys. I'll give you a news shed right on the corner of Flinders Street and Swanston Street. And I'll talk to your parents. So I remember him coming to our place and I told my mum and dad that this important man is coming. He wants me to come out of school. He'll make me a businessman. You know what? My dad said, no, my son's got to go to university.
Join Charles and I next week for the conclusion of his story, of his gaining of a doctorate, and of his work in molecular biology, as well as his travels overseas. But it's his shared experiences of the consequences of ageing that remind us all that ageing is a journey that we're all taking. That's next week, Charles Palagy on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program. Listen to Older Voices is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Community Radio Network.